that's being questioned by the committee.
Is the notion that a master says he does not believe that it's safe to continue transit, even, well, to the extent that he would prefer to be in the other lane or in the separation zone, and yet it doesn't appear that kicks in any policy decision with what happens to the next ship, or whether there's ability of the Coast Guard, and this may be funding or may not be routine, to determine what's going on out there in this passage with ice in it, with super tankers, with 1,200,000 barrels aboard. And in this case, it's alleged that Captain Hazelwood was partially impaired or what have you, but I'm still concerned about the policy. If you're getting heavy calving and you're getting large ice into that channel, this is still left to the master, who's being driven by owners that have called the Department of Energy, that have told you to open the channel, and that master's under as much pressure, if not more, than you. Because your employer happens to be the United States government. His employer happens to be ARCO or Chevron or British Petroleum or what have you. And I'm just concerned of who's in control here. And I don't know the answer, you know, the answer to that. Apparently you do not have, you can either shut down the port or not. And absent that, he advised you he was switching lanes. He didn't request, or you didn't have to approve, as I understand it. So again, we're kind of back, I guess, maybe to what lay people think the Coast Guard does or the power you have, and we find out after an accident that's not necessarily the case. But what it seems to me what we have, and this is a speech for 30 seconds so you don't have to listen, but what we have is a system that's being driven by the fact that that pipeline is pumping 2 million barrels of oil into this sound, and they've got to get it out of here, and they choose not to reduce it, restrict it, turn it off, or anything else. And so the decision to sail or not to sail is really not a dispassionate, independent decision based upon weather, climate, ice, traffic. If the decision is, we got to give up this berth because we got to move somebody else in here. And that concerns me as a matter of policy. And I think that we have to look at, and I think the Appropriations Committee has to look at, in terms of the operations of the Coast Guard. Mr. Durbin asked you about the contingency plan and your rather forthright statement that it didn't work because it didn't work and it wasn't successful. You sign off, you're involved in the contingency plan for the port facility and the operations, as you are in all ports. I just question whether or not you should be involved. I happen to think you should be involved in the overall contingency plan, because you've just been brought in for the crash. And now that we have redeployed military ships, now that we've upset servicemen's leave time with their families, the rotation of ships, all of the other responsibilities that your service has, we've changed that all around. I think maybe we got to think about having the Coast Guard up front deciding, because it's not a question of whether you could have contained 200,000 barrels and cleaned up the sound in 48 hours. Could you have gotten 25,000 barrels of oil off the water? Could you have gotten 50,000 barrels of oil off the water? A dramatically different situation. Could you have gotten 100,000 barrels in 5 or 6 days? In 5 or 6 days, we had 5,000 barrels. And so I think the Coast Guard, we've got to think, is policy. The Coast Guard better, because eventually you're going to get called only in the time of disaster. You know, you monitor the successful ones. You manage the disasters. And I would think if you're going to have be in the position to manage it, you'd like to know what assets are going to be available to be deployed in what period of time. And I don't expect you to make a recommendation. If you have an opinion, that would be fine. I don't expect you to recommend policy.
I certainly agree with what you say. A benevolent dictator would be the best kind of government, as long as it was me. I would like to be able to control the traffic. I would like to have absolute radar coverage over everything that moved. I'd like to force everybody to be a part of the traffic system, so I knew where they were and that we had a good flight following, if you would. I think that's beyond the realm of possibility in the kind of society we have. But I think there's somewhere in between that it should be. What really happened here is that the system failed. We were down to the kicker on a football team making the tackle, and no coach in the world likes to have that. the one person that was running the ship at the moment was put in a position of being the only, our only savior. Somehow we've got to figure a way to save that, and we can probably do it easier in Valdez than we can in other places, because it's a rather closed area with a relatively small amount of traffic. I think of San Francisco Bay with ships running in and out, and I hear five blasts all the time as they come in and out, and other vessels crossing their paths and that sort of thing, which are not, incidentally, unlike icebergs or anything else that gets in their path. So somehow we really have to review the whole system.
Well, again, the Coast Guard there was called in to manage the collision in San Francisco Bay in 71, and we ended up with a traffic management system that dramatically increases our capability to keep track of all of the traffic in the bay. I find it interesting that in 1976, when the Coast Guard was asked to comment on this plan, you basically found it to be well thought out, but you also strongly recommended that there be some pre-positioning of cleanup assets out in the Sound. And now 13 years later, after this tragic event, they're going to take your advice, and apparently some of these new resources that are going to be brought online will be pre-positioned out into the Sound to try to reduce that that response time. So maybe we should have listened to you earlier, and you obviously, the Coast Guard nationwide has a huge involvement with oil spills of all sizes now. You've kind of run the gamut.
Yeah, and we need better skimmers. I've watched these skimmers work, and frankly, I worked in oil spill business back in the early 70s, early to mid-70s, and I don't see a lot of advance in the technology of skimmers, and that's some, but not a great deal. And I looked at the, I must admit, I haven't boarded the Vitagoubsky. I have talked to the people that have. I've had people on there. It's a good concept. I think the dredges that we have been a good concept, but they weren't really designed for skimmers. We need to do some work in that area so we have a better contingency of forces available to do skimming. If we'd had all of the skimmers that we now have, something around 50 to 52 skimmers that are spread out all over the coastal area here, if we'd had all of those on scene at the time the spill occurred, we could have recovered quite a lot of oil until they were full. But you have to pump them off, and they aren't large capacity. We just need to be able to do it better if we're going to have spills.
You know, they say that Santa Barbara drove the technology in terms of blowout equipment. Maybe one of the things that will happen here is this will drive the technology in terms of cleanup. Because if it doesn't, I don't think many communities are going to invite the oil industry in.
Sir,
I'm not sure that that's the result that should happen, but I think that may in fact be the reality. Mr. Owens?
I think I'll pass now.
Mr. DeFazio?
Admiral, or I think probably direct this to the Admiral and Captain. I'd like to know a little bit about the, I've seen Admiral Yost's comments on the transport of the stricken vessel and the precautions that will be taken. I guess what I'm concerned about here is we had a plan in the Red Book. I looked down in paper, contingency plan. It looked pretty good, you know, to the layperson in terms of, you know, capability that's available and possibility of an accident happening once in 241 years. I represent Oregon. The Columbia River is not in my district, but all of us in Oregon care about it. I'd like to know, do we have assurance that the plan to transport the ship and the possibility of further damage from the ship, are we looking at another paper plan and false assurances, or is the Coast Guard absolutely confident that there is no danger to the Columbia River in the transportation of the ship to the Port of Portland to have it put into a dry dock?
Sir, I'm... this is one procedure and operation that we are in control of, and I feel that we have the absolute say over whether the ship will move or not. Whether it goes into the port or not, of course, goes back to Oregon and the other people involved. But we will not allow it to move until we know that it can be moved safely.
Okay. Well, we'll be monitoring that carefully. I'm not certain what my state is going to decide either in terms of having it come in. I'd like to ask about burning, since I followed the line of questioning on the dispersants. Again, Steve, the Exxon statement, just to refresh your memory, they said they did not receive authorization to use dispersants. They go on to say, Exxon also did not receive permission to use open burning until mid-afternoon of the same day, that is, Sunday evening, is my understanding. We're confident that had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants and open burning, the environmental damage from the still would have been significantly mitigated. We've already commented on the dispersants. What about the open burning? Was there a earlier request for open burning which was denied? Were there subsequent requests for open burning that were denied? Was there a request at the time when they did the test burn to do a much more extensive burn that was denied?
As far as I know, there's never been an application to burn oil that has been denied. The initial burn that they did Saturday evening, the 25th, it worked apparently very well. However, it was done in the dark, so it was very difficult to monitor. Any additional burning test, there was no delay from the government side on allowing them to do it. You know, the wind kicked up and moved things around, which obviously made it made getting equipment out there a problem because of the sea state and the weather they were involved in. And then once the wind churned it up and created a mousse, or if not a full mousse, you know, enough water in the oil to where igniting it became very difficult and then impossible. So events overran the ability of the equipment to handle it.
Well, I guess I'll have to ask Exxon, but I mean, you're saying, I mean, their statement is that had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants and open burning, they, the extent of your testimony and Alaska testimony, is they had whatever authority permission they need. They made no requests that were denied.
No, sir. No requests were denied. The ability of the equipment to be ready when they needed to use it was a problem.
Yeah, the fire boom, which we discussed yesterday.
Fire boom and having aircraft ready, you know, in the right time of day with daylight hours to see it was
And the amount of dispersants available and the aircraft equipped to deploy those dispersants.
Yes,
so, I mean, there were very real constraints, but the constraints were not permission from the federal or state government. The constraints were the capability of the contractor or the responsible party to actually conduct those activities.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Pinto.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Admiral. Obviously we're appreciative of the advocacy role that you're playing for the national government. I think it's very important. All the land in the Gulf of Alaska are national lands. I chair the Parks and Public Lands Subcommittee, and we're deeply concerned that these plans are completely silent with regards to realistically dealing with this. I'm not trying to scare anyone, but it looks to me like Exxon is practicing more a legal defense than it is an oil cleanup. I mean, that's the impression I get with the arguments over areas I don't think there should be arguments over, and sort of the putting the finger on one. You have to assume there's going to be some human error here in all of this. I mean, you didn't make an affirmative. Was the decision an affirmative? You have no ability to deal with the ice and to make the ice flows. In other words, you're dealing with wind, is that right? And you're dealing with other factors, but you don't really monitor the ice flows other than what you get reported back. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. The physical equipment we have now, either radar or visual,
well,
doesn't give us the option.
I think that gets to some of the appropriation questions, the importance, the economic importance of this sea lanes. We got testimony saying that they were basically using the large tankers as sort of to guide other smaller tankers in and out. You know, and I don't, maybe that's common practice, but it concerns me that, I mean, I think in this instance there was no, it was a passive decision with regards to maintain or not to close the port. Is that correct?
Well, the quantity of ice that night was not reported to be a problem by any of the masses or the pilots.
We got mixed. I guess now you got a lot more hindsight on that, I guess, than there is. But it was obviously pushing the vessels out of the lanes.
Well, the vessels had the choice of either slowing down or going around. And in this case, as was done 3 hours before the Valdez left, the Arco Juno did virtually the same maneuver up to a point. that the Exxon Valdez is
quite a ways out of the lane, obviously.
Yes, sir.
But for that smudge. Well, I just want to encourage you, Admiral, to pursue the proper type of support and information. We need, obviously, a lot of help. I think, frankly, based on the work, the study I've seen, that some of the Sheen, some of the other products are going to end up in Bristol Bay. And as again, I don't think it's a scare tactic. I think it's a question of being realistic, not necessarily pessimistic. I think that Noah and others said it wasn't going to get in Kenai Fjord. It's there. We've got a lot of oil. I think there's a lot of agreement between you and I in terms of what the nature is. There isn't enough pickup going. We need a lot more resources. And this contingency plan is going to dictate. If we, during this course, permit this contingency plan to be silent on some of these worst case, or at least some of these realistic expectations, then I think the problem is it's not going to be addressed. And I especially am concerned. I appreciate your sensitivity about the park, the wilderness, and archaeological resources, other cultural resources, but frankly, we got to get some of that oil picked up in the water. If we're just going to wait and keep permitting it to take the hit, I think there has to be a better. I think your observations about the state of the art of the equipment are absolutely correct. I just think there has been no demonstrated ability on the part of U.S. Pickup of oil in the Gulf of Alaska, or at least it has been a miserable record. So we look forward to working with you and look forward to your and supporting you and your assistance in trying to develop a plan that has a realistic goal in terms of what's going to happen here, rather than trying to. I think that Exxon and others are involved in legal defense and PR campaigns. I think at the soul of this is really a responsibility of the American people, and you carry that burden up here, and we want to support you in that effort.
Just along those lines, what I am working on right now, we have divided the area up into sectors. We have a Kodiak sector, a Homer sector, and a Seward sector, which I have farmed in a way. I can't farm out my responsibility, but the local oversight, I think, in this case is very important, where the local people that live in that area have some say over their destiny, and so that that Exxon will employ the fishermen, the people in that area, to help clean it up. And what I'm pushing for is to say, to have them work that out in their areas. I visited Kodiak, and I was out at Hollow the other day. I want them to get directly involved in this cleanup operation, because it'll be done a lot better. Great. And not take away from the resources that are in the proposed plan that addresses directly Prince William Sound. And I think by dividing it up like that I can have a lot more success in getting those areas cleaned up quickly, so that doesn't go on all summer. I think that can go very quickly, and those are the kind of things that we're working on. And you're absolutely right.
Just standing back and waiting until it hits the beaches is the worst possible scenario. If we can pick it up in the water, it's a hell of a lot better.
We've almost missed our opportunity to do that.
Well, we've missed it in some places, but we can get out in front of this in the plan. And that's what you should be doing, is making certain that it's realistic and it gets out in front of the issue, rather than being behind the curve, because they've been behind the curve for 40 days, and I think it's going to take a real dramatic type of change in terms of the course and way they're dealing with this.
I agree, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just want very briefly to ask three things. One, there was a Department of Transportation and EPA report to be made to the President on a number of topics relating to this Valdez spill, by April 30th. Has that been made? Do you know?
The Commandant, when he was up here, mentioned that it had been prepared. I have not seen it. I don't know what it said.
Thank you. Secondly, the Arizona Department of Environmental Conservation prepared this chart. Alaska, where are we? Have you seen this chart, sir?
No, sir, I haven't.
I'd like to provide it for you. It shows a very sorry scenario of fulfillment of the contingency plans, and would appreciate very much your looking at it and providing for the committee a report as early as convenient about the many failures of the contingency plan, about which you have not testified today in detail. I don't want to take further of the committee's time today, but we'll provide you with this and ask for your best first-hand testimony as to why that has been such a sorry performance. And then thirdly, I would request that you provide for us as well a report on what personal observations or opinions you have relating to why the handoff in the middle of day two of responsibility for the spill from Alyeska to Exxon. Any circumstances surrounding it, any testimony as to why you think it may have occurred, or any information that you have in that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I was just looking at the testimony of our next witness, and I think I'd better ask you a question here. In this opening discussion of the accident, he says that I will begin by noting that we do not know what caused the accident. We do have certain facts. The accident occurred early Friday morning, March 24th. The weather was clear. The ship had no known mechanical problems. A course change was requested and authorized. Now, I don't know how you read that, but I think the layperson would believe that you had some ability to affect that request.
Well, I think the use of the words is probably a little free. What the rule is, as I understand it, is that they need to advise us that they're going to change course so that we can keep track of their position, and that's what they did. Is that correct, Steve?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. In fact, the exact statement from the radio log or the radio transmission tape indicated that at about 23:25 at night, the Exxon Valdez reported to the traffic center. We may end up over in the inbound lane, outbound transit. We'll notify you when we leave the traffic separation scheme and cross over the separation zone. Over. And my watch stand reported back, Roger that. We'll be awaiting your call. So he advised us, as was proper, that he was going across the traffic lanes.
Do you save steaming time by going across this, doing this maneuver?
Not if he intended to come back. In other words, not to be facetious, he was going over, down, and coming back. And it's you know.
But what usually happens? Do you know?
Excuse me, sir.
What usually happens? Do they come back, or do they stay in? Do they stay on the other side?
They usually come back. Yes,
they usually come back. So there is, in fact, not a savings in terms of,
no,
of
there shouldn't be.
Time of the run.
There would be a savings if they, instead of reducing speed and gently going down the lane, okay, they kept their same departure speed and moved out at.
That's, you know,
they might not waste any time.
Yeah, what's
that's right. That's correct. Yes.
Do you know what that savings might be offhand, roughly? Is it an hour, 2 hours?
Oh, no, I'd say 20 minutes, half
20
hour.
20 minutes,
maximum.
Half hour. So in the run to the lower 48, it's not significant at all.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think this is part of the problem and I think it's maybe what concerned Congressman Vento when your stationery is being used to put out Exxon figures is that there's a bootstrapping process that's going on here. It's not very subtle, but the whole notion is that somehow the government was a complete part of this operation, whether it was the approval of the contingency plan, the authorization of the maneuver by Captain Hazelwood, your involvement in the cleanup. At some point, you're going to be told, a year from now, you signed off, you, the United States government, the United States Coast Guard, the President put you in here, and it was all signed off on, and Exxon's free, sue us. And that's the worst case scenario for the people of Prince William Sound. And that's what concerns me, and I've watched this before. The people, you know, that that were all upset because consumers wouldn't buy their apples a couple of months ago said the government approved this pesticide. We're not responsible, but they lobbied to have the government approve that pesticide, and they beat up the government when people tried to have them remove it. We're now told that this contingency plan is fine because the state signed off on it. We're now told that perhaps this isn't as big a problem for Exxon as it was because you authorized the change of lanes. Just believe me, we're going to be back here with Exxon telling the American public that the Coast Guard signed off on it. We were told, every member of this panel was told that a beach was not clean until the Coast Guard said it was clean. That's what we were told by the Navy. That's what we were told by the working crews. I was told that by the foreman. And that's what we're being told by Exxon. You defined the Coast Guard. And that's a very heavy burden. I expect you didn't ask for this when they called you. Nobody asked for this assignment. But it's a burden that you carry in the name of the public, whether it's the fisherman here, or the tourist, or the person that just is concerned about the environment, or about Alaska, whatever their definition is. It all kind of now focuses down to you. There's been a huge disaster. There's been ineptness. There's been, lack of preparedness. All of that. We're now down to where apparently Exxon is once again trying to get a government signature on a piece of paper to say this is the plan, that it's 340 beaches, lightly oiled beaches, the concerns of the park that Mr. Bento had. That's Mother Nature. You're in a tough spot. I think the president's in a tough spot because we've all been dragged into this because somebody couldn't be prepared in some kind of proper fashion. And I just say, as one who is in representation of the public, as you are, as my colleagues are, we're deeply concerned about how this story ends and whether or not there's a public endorsement of what now, may turn out to be an inadequate response in terms of the cleanup after the disaster of an unmanaged spill by the private sector here. You got a tough duty, Admiral. We appreciate all that you have done, the time and the gentleman sitting behind you and the people you've taken off of other duty chores who to have come up here. We really got to tell you how much we appreciate it and how much I think the people of Alaska appreciate the fact that you're now on site getting some say over this. Let me just finish by saying we would like you to submit for the record, and we'll make this in a formal request, but the radio logs for the March 24th, April 8th, the transcripts of phone calls the 24th and the time thereafter, and the your film on the dispersants. And I think we had one other request, but we'll put that in writing to you. And unless there's other comments by my colleagues,
could I certainly after that? It's it may be a counterproductive, but there's a couple of things I would like to say. One is that I forgot to mention to Mr. Vento when we were talking that we have pre-positioned NOAA and others have pre-positioned some people down in the Bristol Bay area so that they are daily flying a helicopter that Exxon has provided to keep tabs on any oil that may be coming through Unimak Pass and moving up that way. So we are trying to keep ahead of that. One has to recognize that coming through that area, it's a delightful place for people to pump their bilges. So we do get sheens in that area that we don't like, but we haven't been able to stop that aren't associated with this. It's very important that we keep ahead of this and make sure that that doesn't happen, and we're going to give it our best try. The other thing that, if I could get to the lower 48, and this is usually left on the cutting room floor, the thought that all of Alaska isn't covered with oil. And I think that to send that signal that perhaps it is hurts tourism and hurts the fishing industry and hurts a lot of people that it ought not to hurt. In terms of the amount of shoreline that Alaska has, this great state, it's a relatively small amount, and we're doing everything we can to keep it out of the water column so that it doesn't affect the fish, and all the information that I have so far is that it hasn't, but We are trying very hard to make that happen, and that if we could get that feeling down to the lower 48, I think that would be of value.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time and your cooperation and all the help that you've been. Captain McCall, thank you also for
thank
your
you.
Help.
Is a 2-minute break?
Yeah. I think what we'll do is we'll take a 5-minute break here to give the reporter something we forgot to do yesterday, a chance, and everybody can stretch their legs. And then we'll hear from the next panel that will be made up of Mr. W.D. Stevens, the president of Exxon Company, Frank Arasi, the president of Exxon Shipping Company, Otto Harrison, the general manager of the Valdez Operations Exxon Shipping Company.
We just heard Chairman George Miller of California announcing a short break. We'll be back with, of course, Exxon will be the witnesses up next. We've been hearing from the Coast Guard, Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins and Captain Steve McCall. For KCHU and the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. We will return with more live coverage of the oil spill hearings by the House Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources following the committee's recess. Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources. Here is Chairman George Miller swearing in a panel of Exxon executives.
Got a convenience to bring them forward. If you don't anticipate that time, that's also well and good.
Okay.
It is the practice of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it at investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
I do not.
Would you please rise and raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
I do.
Thank you. In order to inform you of your rights as witnesses before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of rules have previously been provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel?
I do not.
Do not.
Do not. Thank you. Stevens, we'll start with you, and you proceed in the manner in which you're most comfortable. I want you also to know that you're certainly free to comment on anything that you heard. If you were here in the room earlier this morning or yesterday, that you're certainly free to do that. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start with a prepared statement on behalf of all of us. I'm Bill Stevens, president of Exxon Company USA. I'm here today to describe Exxon's efforts to deal with the Exxon Valdez oil spill and its consequences. To help me with your questions about the spill, I'm accompanied today, to my right, by Mr. Frank Arasi, who's president of Exxon Shipping Company and was the senior manager in charge of the first 14 days of Exxon's response to the spill. And to my left, by Mr. Otto Harrison, who took over from Frank on day 15 and remains today in charge of Exxon's cleanup operations. Let me say at the outset that we do not know what caused this accident. The National Transportation Safety Board hearing on May 16th will provide more information on the cause of the accident, and we look forward to having the results of its detailed investigation. Confronted with the accident and a 250,000 barrels of oil on the water on the morning of March 24th, Exxon's response was prompt and consistent with the previously approved contingency plan. Within 3 hours of the spill, Exxon Shipping Company set up a casualty response center in Houston. In the first few hours, arrangements were made for the first flights to airlift equipment. Our key team managers were in the air the morning the spill occurred and on site here in Valdez 18 hours after the vessel grounding. Dozens more trained people and tons of supplies began arriving that afternoon and have continued arriving daily. On arrival, one of the response team's several immediate priorities was to prevent the 1 million barrels of crude remaining on the ship from leaking into the Sound. And I should add here that the current estimate of oil spilled is 260,000 barrels. On Saturday, March 25th, the first day after the spill, We began the difficult and risky process of lightering, transferring oil from the first into the first of three Exxon tankers. These transfers were successfully completed on April 4. From the outset, the Exxon team moved rapidly to assemble materials and personnel to recover the spilled oil on the water and to protect the most sensitive threatened areas of Prince William Sound. We supplied equipment and worked with local fishermen's groups to place boom at five key fish hatcheries on the west side of the sound. All of these have been successfully protected from the spill's effects. On April 2nd, 9 days after the spill, a shoreline cleanup priority committee was formed, and on April 8th, preliminary approval was obtained from the Coast Guard and eight other agencies for a shoreline cleanup strategy. An initial plan was presented by Exxon on April 14th and approved by the Coast Guard on April the 17th. A revised plan was submitted on May 1st, incorporating new data on impacted shorelines from ADEC and input from the Interagency Shoreline Advisory Committee, and also recognizing that Exxon's operational buildup has and will proceed at a faster pace. This plan, like the initial plan, must be approved by the Coast Guard, acting as federal on-scene coordinator on behalf of all involved state and federal agencies. Specific milestones have been set for shoreline cleanup, which has commenced and is expected to be completed by mid-September. The revised plan provides for the cleanup of 364 miles of shoreline. The work will follow four priorities established in consultation with state and federal authorities and environmental experts. The 364 miles of shoreline provided for in the plan is based on an April 21st Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation survey, plus an allowance by Exxon for non-surveyed areas, principally in the Gulf of Alaska. The plan specifically addresses the work needed to complete surveying and mapping of all impacted shorelines. Our initial response, as I noted earlier, was consistent with the actions envisioned in the oil spill contingency plan developed by Alyeska and reviewed and approved by state and federal authorities. While it was considered to be unlikely, the approved contingency plan did consider the possibility of a 200,000-barrel spill in the sound, about the same size and in roughly the same vicinity as the Exxon Valdez spill. The approved plan recognized that a spill of that magnitude could not be fully contained. Large volumes of oil would reach the shore, and a significant cleanup effort would be required. The approved contingency plan emphasized the importance of early use of dispersants and open burning. As you've noted, Exxon did not receive authorization to use dispersants other than for two tests until the end of the three-day period, Sunday evening, March 26. Exxon also did not receive permission to use open burning until mid-afternoon of the same day. We're confident that had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants, the environmental damage from the spill would have been significantly mitigated. In addition to our efforts to contain and clean up the spill, we've mobilized to mitigate the economic impact on the communities affected by the spill. We currently have 50 people handling claims on the scene, and we've opened claims offices in Valdez, Cordova, Homer, Kodiak, and Seward. We've worked with hatcheries, canneries, fishermen's groups, city and rural governments, and many individuals to assure their financial viability while claims are being processed. While we tackled the task of removing oil from the ship and from the water, we also moved quickly to assess and deal with the environmental effects of the spill. As part of our initial response, Exxon assembled a team of environmental experts to provide advice to our response team on the best ways to go about cleanup to mitigate damage to the environment. This team, working with federal and state personnel, moved quickly to identify sensitive areas for protection and to assess biological and ecological impacts of the spill on water quality, sediment, and marine life. Also within the first 2 or 3 days, we had treatment centers set up for oiled birds and otters in Valdez, manned by experts Exxon brought in from California wildlife institutions. Later, bird and otter rehabilitation centers were established in Seward and additional bird centers in Kodiak and Homer. It's just over 6 weeks since the accident, and we are today in the midst of an extensive oil recovery and cleanup operation. I believe that by our actions, we and Exxon have shown our intention to deal responsibly with the spill and its effects. We cannot undo what happened. However, we can and are taking every reasonable action to limit the damage, clean up, and otherwise mitigate the impact. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll turn it open for questions.
Thank you very much. Let me just clarify one point. Your statement is somewhat different from one that we previously had handed out. Which one would you like to become part of the formal record? Are you summarizing
No, I summarized what we submitted.
All right. Mr. Rossi, you became responsible for the running of the cleanup effort. Is that correct?
Yes, I got the call at 4:25 Houston time Friday morning. That's 1:25 Alaska time.
Have you done this before? Have you managed to clean up?
Yes, I had one other opportunity, if you can call it that, and that was in early March of this year. That was the first time in 7 years as president of the shipping company that I had such an opportunity. But that was the second call I got.
And that was a spill of what size and where?
It was a spill of 800 barrels of oil off the coast of Oahu. I believe the date was March 2nd or 3rd. We had a vessel at an offshore mooring buoy. Due to some high winds, the chain which holds the vessel to the mooring buoy parted, and before the vessel could regain control, it grounded on a reef. And we lost about 200 barrels of fuel oil, and the terminal lost about 600 barrels of cargo out of the hose that went to the mooring buoy.
And that's the extent of your involvement in an oil spill?
It was a major response. It was a major response, yes. Prior to that, I had a major role in the late 1970s in reviewing and revising and making major modifications to Exxon's response plan. So many of the things, most of the things we put in place, I was responsible for actually planning and developing back in 1978, 79.
Now, you flew from Houston to Valdez, correct? I mean,
yes.
You came immediately. You arrived here when?
We got here at 5:37 Alaska time. My first activities after getting the call at 4:25 Houston time was to make a number of calls to put in place a response plan. I then went from there to our Houston office. That was about 7:30 in the morning, and we had that response center open. It was a holiday, so no one was there. And we had to mobilize the people, and we had our Houston response center in operation at 7:30. Our first activities there were to mobilize.
You got here at 5:30 in the afternoon Friday.
Yes. Yeah. 5:37 Friday afternoon, Alaska time. Day one.
So go ahead. You were describing what you did before.
We put in place all of the initial steps of the response plan, which were to mobilize the stockpile out of San Francisco Bay. That's the Clean Seas stockpile, to mobilize the stockpile out of Southampton, England, to mobilize a spray plane. The plane was actually in Florida. I think you asked that question earlier.
So this is the same plane that we're tracking across the country. The plane was in Florida?
Yes, it made a stop in Arizona to pick up the ads pack. It then went from Arizona to Anchorage. It arrived in Anchorage 6:05 on Saturday morning. So we had the two stockpiles going. We had the mobilized We had that spray plane and one other spray plane out of British Columbia. That was a DC-6. We also chartered another jet freight to pick up dispersant. So we had one plane on the way with dispersant. And we then began to call all of the outside experts, which are part of our response team. And there are quite a number of them. I can go through them if you'd like. Some of them are very important to this operation. We then scheduled a flight with the company's plane. It's a 6-passenger flight, and I picked 5 people that I wanted with me. We also had 3 other managers come up from San Francisco, our San Francisco office, and we had 3 people in Anchorage. So that made 12. All 12 of those people were here by 5:37 Friday night. We had another 20 people in the air Friday. Unfortunately, they didn't make it to Alaska before dark, so they had to spend the night in Anchorage. As you know, you can't get in and out of LD's airport other than daylight, as long as the cover is right. But they were here Saturday morning. And as of Saturday morning, we had 32 people in the Exxon response team.
Now those, so you, when yesterday we spent a fair amount of time discussing when this operation was handed off from Alyeska to you. What is your perception of when that took place? Was that prior to your arrival, after your arrival?
Oh, no, it started shortly after we landed. Two of the people that were in that group of 12 were to become the on-scene commander and the operations manager as defined in our organization. They went over and met with the Alyeska people and picked up immediately 3 tasks, and this is Friday night. The 3 tasks were the contact with the Coast Guard and met with the Alyeska people. And picked up immediately 3 tasks, and this is Friday night. The 3 tasks were the contact with the Coast Guard.